progress concerning what I'm going to talk about today actually happened here at the Perimeter Institute. So it really is a pleasure to be here giving this talk. So before I begin, I finally feel like I'm in Canada now that I have a hockey stick. Before I begin, I just want to give a bit of philosophical motivation, I guess, for what inspires me to look at this problem. And it really comes from the fact that quantum field theory is kind of here to stay. It's emerged as the most precise theory of nature, and its application now goes beyond what it was originally designed for particle physics. Essentially all fields of physics now use quantum field theory, everything from condensed matter physics all the way to quantum gravity. Everyone uses this common language, and nature doesn't always give us easy quantum field theories. Sometimes things are non-perturbative, and we need new tools to actually solve really interesting problems. And so when we can say things that are general about quantum field theory, they go beyond perturbation theory, beyond supersymmetry, beyond other assumptions, then we're really learning something, I think, and we're making progress, and we're really learning the underlying structure of quantum field theory. So I think that's really what's going on here in these C theorems. So the basic idea of a C theorem is we want to find something, some quantity which we can compute in a field theory which decreases under our G flow. So I'm going to start with kind of a long introduction going over the history of C theorems and quantum field theory. And then I'm finally going to get to the F theorem, which is the main subject of this talk. So the F theorem is the proposal for a C theorem in three dimensions that is kind of, it seems like it might actually be true. And then after giving the motivation and giving the definition, I'm going to go into some examples, and these examples are kind of going to slowly increase in complexity. Finally, I'll get to some supersymmetric examples where we can use supersymmetric localization. And then at the end, if I have time, I'll talk about renormalized entanglement entropy, and I'll tell you what that means, and also give you some examples. But really, the important part of this talk is at the beginning, and so as it progresses, it'll get a bit more technical, but really the first part is the part, the message of the first part is what I want you to walk away with. So I'm putting this long list of papers up here just so I can acknowledge my collaborators. I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of amazing people on this subject over the past 2 years or so. So Daniel Jaffris, Igor Klebanov, Sylvia Pufu, Sibir Sachdev, Tatsuma Nishioka. So if anything I say is confusing, then I recommend you look at one of our papers, because my collaborators were probably much better at explaining it than I will be. Also, this business with the F theorem has really been a collaboration amongst many different research groups, and I will most certainly leave out a reference to someone's work that was important. So I'm sorry if I do, but if you are also interested in something I say which pertains to another paper, you can come up to me afterwards. I can try to give you the reference. So let me tell you what I mean by a C theorem first. So we say that a quantity C satisfies a C theorem if it obeys two properties. And by the way, when I'm talking about quantum field theories, I'm implicitly meaning unitary and relativistic field theories. So this quantity C needs to decrease monotonically under RG flow, and it needs to be stationary at conformal fixed points. And I'm going to return to this second point in a few slides. So if you're a bit confused what it means, don't worry quite yet. So what does the C theorem give us? It gives us an ordering in quantum field theories. If we have a C theorem and we can compute C in some theory and compute it in another, then the theory which has the higher C, we can flow from that theory to the theory with the lower C, but we know, even if we can't calculate anything else in these theories, we know that we can't flow from the theory with the lower C to the theory with the higher C. So it's really telling us something powerful. Even just this one quantity is telling us something quite powerful. So what is known? Well, the canonical example, the first example, is the Zomological C theorem. And this is in two dimensions. And I'm going to talk about this on the next slide. So it turns out that generalizing the Zomological C theorem, well, the proposal is kind of straightforward. Once you understand the Zomological C theorem in the right way, then it doesn't take too much thought to write down what the proposal should be in higher dimensions. Proving it is another matter. And that was done recently by Komorgatsky and Schwimmer just this past year, or year before. But going to odd dimensions turns out to be different. I'll say why it's different, but essentially there's no conformal anomaly in odd dimensions, and that is the foundation for formulating these C theorems in even dimensions. So we have to look for something else, and the proposal is that it should be this quantity F that we should be looking at. So at conformal fixed points, this quantity F, it's minus the log of the partition function of the theory on the three sphere. And I should say that there's a recent proof proposed by Cassini and Huerta. I'll tell you a bit what's involved in their proof, but it actually seems like this might be something that's true. So C theorems in higher dimensions are still unproven, even though there are proposals. As I said, in even dimensions, the proposal is natural, and actually Cardi wrote it in his paper where he proposed the A theorem. And there is some recent work by some people here towards proving the 60A theorem, but I don't think it's quite proven yet. There's also a natural generalization of the F theorem to higher dimensions. So we now have a proposal in all odd dimensions. Again, it hasn't been proven except in three dimensions. Okay, so I want to now review Zomolodchikov's C theorem, because it's really a pretty amazing result. You can actually almost write the entire proof on one slide, except for one or two details. And there's a whole structure associated with this T theorem that's pretty amazing. So Timu Nu here is the stress tensor, and I'm using complex coordinates, and I want to define these three functions. These functions are correlation functions of the stress tensor. So before we go any farther, let's just think about what happens at a conformal fixed point. So at a conformal fixed point, the only thing here that's non-vanishing is F. And in the TTOPE, you get a leading term, which goes like C over 2Z to the fourth. So this F here is just going to be C. And so we define, Zomolodchikov defined the C function this way. You can see that at conformal fixed points, this function C of R squared just equals little c, the anomaly coefficient. So it takes about two or three lines of algebra to show this, but if you take a derivative of C with respect to R squared, then this thing is actually proportional to H. And the amazing thing about H is that it's the expectation value of something squared, and the expectation value of something squared turns out to be greater than or equal to zero in a unitary quantum field theory. And it's only zero at the fixed points. So immediately, we see there's a monotonicity property. So it's a pretty amazing result. It's quite simple. But to try to generalize this to higher dimensions, it turns out to be useful to think about it in some different ways. So what's really going on here? At a conformal fixed point, this H is zero. Conformal symmetry should imply that the trace of the stress tensor just vanishes. But there's a vital anomaly. And in a curved space, this isn't true, it's violated. And so little c here is the anomaly coefficient, r is the curvature scalar. So how can we isolate c? Well, one thing we could do is we could just pick a specific geometry and we could just integrate this equation. So let's just integrate it on a two-sphere, and this naturally gives us C. Now, this might seem unnecessarily complicated for this example, but it turns out to be useful to write this integral of the expectation value of the stress tensor as the derivative of the free energy with respect to the radius. So it just takes a few lines of algebra to show that these two equations are true. And it's useful when we try to go to four dimensions. So in four dimensions, there's also a Weyl anomaly. But now we have two anomaly coefficients. We have A and C. So which one do we choose? A priori, they look the same to me. So how should we differentiate between them? Well, one thing you could try to do, one thing maybe you would think to yourself is, before we looked at the integral on the two-sphere, why not look at the integral on the four-sphere? So this is just kind of some hand-waving motivation, but this was Cardi's inspiration. And it turns out that C does not satisfy a C theorem. Sorry, the notation here is a bit confusing. This C had nothing to do with the C from two dimensions. So this C here has no monotonicity property. It doesn't decrease under RG flow. This A, it turns out it does. So we can play the same trick, and we can write it as a derivative of the free energy with respect to the radius of the sphere. So again, Cardi proposed this A theorem a bit over 20 years ago now. And recently, Komogorsky and Swimmer proved the A theorem. And they did so by constructing some interpolating function between the fixed points, just like this interpolating function that Cardi gave us, except that their interpolating function is a bit more complicated, so I'm not going to write it down. Does this make sense so far?
Is it also true that if you take this definition through the free energy, it's also monotonic, or it's not true?
Well, not every RG flow that you can have on flat space you can have on the sphere. And so it turns out looking at the free energy away from conformal fixed points isn't quite a useful way to go. If you're working in perturbation theory, then you can consider these RG flows on the sphere, and you can construct some monotonic function. But as soon as you try to go beyond perturbation theory or look at more non-trivial RG flows, it's better to just think about the RG flows happening in flat space. So the proof of the A theorem was preceded by more than 20 years of evidence, and I guess I should say not just evidence, but application. People were really using this and trying to constrain beyond the standard model physics. But a lot of this evidence came from studying quantum field theory with some amount of supersymmetry. And so the thing I want to concentrate on is, or the thing I want to stress, is A maximization. So, and supersymmetric quantum field theory, A can be written as a function of the trial R charges, and it turns out that the correct R symmetry at the superconformal fixed points locally maximizes A. And the only reason I'm mentioning this is because we're going to see that there's something analogous in three dimensions. And this was kind of some of the early motivation for why we should consider F in three dimensions, is that there's something analogous to this. Okay, so let's turn to three dimensions now. So there is no anomaly in odd dimensions. The trace of the stress tensor just vanishes no matter what manifold we put this thing on. So that trick isn't going to work. So what do we do? Well, there have been a lot of previous attempts. Here's one of them. So it turns out in two dimensions, pretty much everything is related to everything else, which is nice, but it's also can be confusing when you try to go beyond two dimensions. So if you consider the thermal free energy in two dimensions, this coefficient here I labeled C theorem is actually just proportional to the Weyl anomaly coefficient C. So that also satisfies some monotonicity property. So maybe we could think that the natural way to generalize to higher dimensions is by looking at the thermal free energy, looking at this coefficient C theorem. But that turns out not to work, and here's one reason why it doesn't work. There's actually a counterexample. And this counterexample is going to be important to me later on, so I'll go into more detail. But what it is, it's an RG flow from the critical Owen model fixed point to the Goldstone phase of N-1 free fields. I'm going to have much more to say about this RG flow. But it's not monotonic. It increases under this RG flow, so immediately we can rule this out as a good C function. So what then do we do to go to three dimensions? So here's the insight that this is what we were originally thinking when we were trying to think of a quantity. So in D dimensions, if you take the derivative of the free energy on a D sphere, then this is proportional to the integral of the trace of the stress tensor. Let's consider D to be even for now, like 2 or 4. Then if we integrate this equation, we see that the free energy has a log divergence. Let's call it log epsilon. And the coefficient is going to be the A-type anomaly coefficient. So if there's a log divergence, then it doesn't make sense to talk about the finite part of the free energy. Because by just rescaling the cutoff, we're going to change this finite part. We're going to change the cutoff independent part. But if the log divergence isn't there, if there is no anomaly, then this finite part has some chance of being universal. And since we were supposed to be considering free energies on spheres, why not just look at this finite part? So that's the proposal. In three dimensions, you can compute the free energy of the CFT on the three sphere, and then you look at the finite part of the free energy, the cutoff independent part of the free energy. And this is supposed to satisfy a C theorem. And this is what we mean when we say the F theorem. So just to be explicit, you have a fixed point. You can map this CFT to the three sphere. You can compute the free energy, call this FUV. Now in flat space, you have an RG flow to an IR fixed point. Once you're at that IR fixed point, you can map this CFT to the three sphere, compute its free energy, and this is what we call FIR. And FUV should be bigger than FIR. So one of the other original pieces of evidence came from what is known as F maximization. And that is in n equals 2 supersymmetric theories in three dimensions, you can write F as a function of the chiral R charges. I'll say what this means precisely later on. And F is locally maximized as a function of these chiral R charges. So this is some direct analog of A maximization. So F is also related to entanglement entropy. Sorry, this picture isn't very clear, but what's going on, this is some plane at t equals 0 in three dimensions, and my entangling surface is just the circle of radius r. My entangling region A is the interior of this circle, and the outside is B. So to calculate the entanglement entropy, it's the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix that's constructed by tracing over the degrees of freedom which live in tracing over the density matrix of the vacuum with the degrees of freedom which live in B. So it was shown by Cassini, Huerta, and Myers that this is actually equivalent at conformal fixed points to calculating the free energy on a sphere. And I've written it here for the three sphere, but this is actually true in odd dimension and even dimensions as well. So for example, in two dimensions, the entanglement entropy in an interval has a log divergence. And the coefficient of this log divergence is C. In four dimensions, the entanglement entropy across a sphere has a log divergence, and the coefficient of this log divergence is A. But in odd dimensions, namely in three dimensions, the finite part of the entanglement entropy, it just gives us this F value from the three sphere. So independently, Myers and Senhad proposed that the finite part of this entanglement entropy should satisfy a C theorem. And I guess only later it was kind of realized that everything that we were saying and they were saying was actually the same thing. But why is this useful to have some formulation in terms of entanglement entropy? Well, for one, entanglement entropy just has to do with flat space. We don't have to map something to the sphere. And we can't map every RG flow to the sphere. So this gives us some way potentially to go beyond the conformal fixed points and to actually define a function along the RG flow. So before I move on, yeah.
Sorry, if you trace everything in the free energy of free sphere, in the intermediate energy scale where CFT is not there, I mean, how do you overcome the ambiguity in writing down a theory of free sphere?
So the prescription is you have a UV fixed point. Uh-huh. At this UV fixed point, you can map the theory to the sphere. In compute F. In between, you're not supposed to be considering the theory on the sphere. You consider the theory in flat space. And then once you're at the IR fixed point, you can map back to the sphere and you can compute F.
Okay, Okay, so away from the fixed points, you can't phrase things on the three sphere partition.
No, no. That's why this formulation is useful.
Okay.
So if you haven't seen entanglement entropy, it probably looks a bit ominous. Here's my one picture explanation for how entanglement entropy works. So entanglement entropy has the leading area law divergence. I'm just drawing this picture here for three dimensions. So this is some spatial plane at t equals 0. Let's just consider some spin system. So we have some spins which are entangled with their neighbors. That's what I mean by these little red circles. This black circle, this black dotted circle, this is my entangling region. And when I construct the entanglement entropy, essentially what I'm doing is I'm just counting the number of pairs connected by red circles, which are split in half by this dotted black circle. So these pairs are entangled. The inside, the degrees of freedom in the inside of the sphere, inside of the circle, are entangled with the degrees of freedom on the outside. So roughly, how many such pairs are there? Well, we have the cutoff, epsilon, and we want to divide the circumference of this circle by the cutoff, and that should roughly tell us how many pairs of spins are entangled. So this is called the area law. So the entanglement entropy always has this 2 pi r over epsilon divergence. And this isn't what we're interested in, because this depends on how you define the UV theory, the details of the cutoff, the details of the lattice. We're concerned with the long-range entanglement, with this long-range behavior. And in three dimensions, that comes in through this quantity f. So does this picture make sense to people? So as I was mentioning, the nice thing about talking about entanglement entropy is that we can define this in flat space away from conformal fixed points. So Liu and Mazet, they had a proposal for what's called the renormalized entanglement entropy. And it's written here in terms of derivatives of the entanglement entropy. And what this function does is it gets rid of this area law divergence. This renormalized entanglement entropy is finite, cutoff independent quantity. And we can also define it away from conformal fixed points, and it's still finite and cutoff independent. And then Cassini and Huerta showed that this function actually has some monotonicity property away along the RG flow. So at the fixed points, this just equals our f value. And in between, it's a monotonically decreasing function. So essentially, they proved the F theorem using this function. I should say that the proof is pretty non-trivial. It involves some things like strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy, unitarity, Lorentz invariance. They actually had a similar proof in two dimensions using the same ideas. And they just took that argument, made it a bit more complicated going to three dimensions, and the proof carried over. And so this proved the F theorem. So I just want to make one small point. And this small point, maybe you'll think it's a detail. I'm not sure if it's a detail or not. But it has to do with this function not being really well behaved. Yeah?
You do define F along the LG flow.
Yeah.
Along the LG flow, you have a scale. So why this S minus S prime does not depend on the radius of the circle?
So it does depend on the radius of the circle. That's why it's going to be some non-trivial function. So for example, these two plots here, so let's just look at the F one at the left plot first. This is the plot of this renormalized entanglement entropy for the massive scalar field, free massive scalar field. And so there it makes sense to plot f as a function of mr squared, where m is the mass and r is the radius of the circle. And we see just by looking at the plot that it's a monotonically decreasing function, which goes from some value at the UV fixed point to actually, in this case, zero in the infrared, because once in the infrared, we just have the trivial theory. There's nothing.
So you mentioned proof in two dimensions. But in two dimensions, this logarithmic, there are logarithmic divergences.
So the function is different in two dimensions.
Yeah, sure, but rid of cosmic divergence, there is always a...
So what you do is you take some derivative to essentially just give you the coefficient of the log divergence. So in two dimensions of the function you construct, at the fixed points, it'll just give you C. And along the RG flow, it just gives you something which interpolates between the UVC and the IRC.
What about four dimensions?
It's not known if these methods, if they can also be used to prove the A theorem in four dimensions. That hasn't been done yet. There are some technical issues when trying to bring this proof to higher dimensions. Yeah?
This kind of argument seems to identify the RG flow with just change of the radius of the sphere. Is it obvious that those are the same thing? I mean, one has to do with
and a relativist
kind of coarse graining of the theory, and the other one is just seems to be changing the geometry in which you're evaluating a non-coarse grain quantity, or at least that's... Can you comment on that?
So you could have made the same complaint in Zamolodchikov's C theorem. Because there he's also just writing some function with respect to this radius. And in a relativistic CFT, it turns out that these are all the same thing. Looking at this F as a function of the radius, this is looking at F along the RG flow. Because we're going to longer distances. In a non-relativistic CFT, there might be some issues.
So how do you see that there's, what's special about the relativistic case?
Well, changing length is the same as changing energy. I don't know if I can say much more than that. It's instructive to actually look at examples, and you'll see that it always turns out to be this way. For example, in the massive scalar field, this F ends up being a function of MR squared, which is a dimensionless coupling. So it's not just a function of, it's not a function of the radius and of M independently, it's a function of their dimensionless combination. And this is always the case. You always end up with a function of the dimensionless coupling. And this is what it makes sense to plot things with respect to. So in this example, the picture on the left, I'm plotting F with respect to the dimensionless coupling MR squared. If I had a more complicated RG flow, I would want to plot F with respect to the dimensionless coupling. Okay, so let me return to this point about F not being stationary. So on the right here, this is a plot of Zamolodchikov's C function in two dimensions for a massive scalar field. And I'm also plotting it with respect to MR squared. So there's a pretty big difference between these two functions at small mass. So let me tell you more specifically what I mean about stationarity. Let me perturb by some operator with dimension d minus little delta. So when little delta is 0, this is some marginal deformation. And when I perturb by some exactly marginal deformation, I don't want my C quantity to change. So that's why you can see below, when little delta is 0, C stays the same. But I don't want there to be a term linear in G. Because if there is a term linear in G, then imagine I could have an RG flow that doesn't care about the sign of G. I can make G positive or negative. Then you can see I can make C go up or go down. So how is this rectified in the case of this renormalized entanglement entropy? Well, as soon as we change the mass squared from being positive to being negative, we're changing our vacuum. And this F has to do with the vacuum entanglement entropy. And so what this is saying is even if we are just in some neighborhood around the UV fixed point, if we're changing our vacuum, then we might need to know something about what's happening way, way lower down along the RG flow. Because we need to know about what the final vacuum is. So it's telling us that this F is kind of non-local along the RG flow. And in practice, this just makes it really hard to compute this renormalized entanglement entropy, because we can't do perturbation theory in the usual sense. So for example, this case on the left here, when I plotted this function, This is for a free massive scalar field. We had to put the theory on a lattice and compute this thing numerically. We can't even do perturbation theory at small mass because this F is really non-local along this RG flow. So I don't know how big of a problem this is going to end up being, but it's an open question if there is a nicer C function which satisfies the stationarity requirement. That's easier to compute. Along with it, it would most definitely be easier to compute. So I think that's an open question. Okay, so this concludes the introduction. So now let me just mention some examples of how you can actually calculate this F. Were there any questions so far? Okay. So the simplest example I can think of, the simplest examples are just free fields. So let's just consider a free conformal scalar field. This is the UV fixed point of this plot on the left. And notice the value is about 0.06. So how do I compute this thing? Well, first I have to map this theory to the three sphere. I do so by putting in some conformal coupling to the curvature. Then I just have some one loop determinant. This is kind of an elementary problem. We just need to find the eigenvalues and the degeneracies of this operator. And we can quickly write down this expression. So mu naught here is the UV cutoff. And we can expand out this logarithm. We have one term which has log mu naught and one which has log of the lambda n. So there is going to be a term which has the sum from n equals 0 to infinity of the mn times the log of mu naught. And when you evaluate this with your favorite regularization scheme, this actually vanishes. And this is actually the statement in this example that there is no conformal anomaly in three dimensions. If you wrote down the analogous expression in four dimensions, you would actually see that the regularized sum over the degeneracies doesn't vanish. And in fact, it would exactly give you what you would expect from the anomaly arguments. So in this case, we just have the finite part left over. And you can evaluate it however you'd like, but we do so by zeta function regularization. And this is the value you get. And this is actually the same value that was on that plot that we found by doing the numerics. This is some nice consistency check that everything is working. But it's just some number. So you can do the same thing with a free fermion. Here's the Majorana fermion. It's almost the same number, just there's a plus instead of a minus in the middle. And it's bigger by a bit from the scalar. So we can combine these two to make a chiral multiplet, a free chiral multiplet. And this is what we have. The zetas cancel. And you just have log 2 over 2. It's a nice quantity. So did this example make sense to people? This is the simplest example of how to calculate F. So let's slightly go from complexity. I'm going to leave out most of the details here so that I can get to more interesting examples. But what I want to do is I want to take some unperturbed CFT, just some conformal fixed point with action S naught, and I want to perturb it by some slightly relevant operator. So here I'm actually going to consider the RG flow happening on the three sphere. I can do it for this case, in this perturbative case. So before I talk about what happens when we perturb this action, I'm sure you can all guess that the theory is going to flow. Let me just say the conformal invariance fixes the coefficients of the 2 and 3 point functions. S here is the chordal distance between x and y on the three sphere. So namely, there's this coefficient c in the 3 point function. This coefficient c has nothing to do with any c function. I'm just calling it capital C. And this depends on the theory. Depends on the theory with action S naught. So does the setup make sense? Okay. So this theory flows, it has some beta function. And it's a few line calculation to actually find what the beta function is, but this is what it is. And if you just solve for when this is zero, you'll see that there is a perturbative fixed point if C is greater than 0. And this is the value G star is the value of G at this perturbative fixed point. This is the value of G for which the beta function vanishes. So in this case, we have some perturbative, we flow to some perturbative fixed point. And then the natural question to ask is, what happens to F under this RG flow? We know it should decrease, but can we actually see this in practice? And it turns out you can. It's another 2 or 3 line calculation to get this result. But you find that this is the change in the free energy. So by delta F, I mean F at the IR minus F of the UV. This should be negative, and it is negative. So this is some sign that we know what we're doing and that we can actually compute this thing. And again, this was one of the original examples that we had. So, yeah. So let me move on to a slightly more complex example. So the setup is actually quite similar. I'm again perturbing some UV CFT, but this time I'm going to perturb by some, I'm going to have some double trace deformation in a large N CFT. I'll say in a moment where large N is going to come in, but this is the perturbed partition function that we want to calculate. So the ranges on these on the dimension delta here, the higher dimension d over 2, we want phi squared to be relevant. So we're just saying dimension of phi squared has to be less than d. And we want phi to be some unitary operator, so that's the lower bound. So there are general arguments that I'm not going to go into that say that this theory should flow to a fixed point where phi has dimension d minus delta. So how does the free energy change between the IR fixed point and the UV fixed point? It's a pretty short calculation to actually do this. Let me just sketch it. So we can compare the partition functions, the partition function when we perturb and the unperturbed partition function. And what I've done above is I've just rewritten the partition function by introducing some auxiliary field sigma. If you think about integrating out sigma, you'll see that you'll just recover the partition function that I wrote above. But it's actually useful to do this. And by the way, when I have these expectation values with a sub-naught, I just mean expectation values in the UV CFT. So why is this useful? Well, I'm going to concentrate on this term that goes like sigma times phi. So I have the expectation value of an exponential. What I can do is I can expand this exponential, and I can take the expectation value of each term. And in the large N CFT, what I mean by large N is that higher point functions are suppressed relative to the two-point function by inverse powers of N. So then I can exponentiate this thing, and I get some result, which is just corrected by terms that go like 1 over N. So now I just have some Gaussian integral in sigma that I have to do. And I can just do this Gaussian integral, and I just get some one-loop determinant. A here is the radius of the sphere. I want to send this to infinity. Now it's a three-line calculation to do this, but after a bit of work, you actually get to this formula. So don't worry if you didn't follow the steps. I went pretty quickly. But this delta F as a function of delta, this is the change in the free energy between the IR CFT and the UV CFT as a function of the dimension of my perturbing operator. And so I'm just plotting it below here. You can see that it's always a negative, which is good. That means it's consistent with the F theorem. At the lower bound, when delta is just 1/2, all we've done is just integrate out a massive scalar field. So this just gives us minus 0.06. This is just the F value for a scalar that we saw before. And as delta goes to 3/2, our operator is phi squared. It's marginal, so the free energy doesn't change. So there's an important special case. And this special case is when delta equals 1. This describes the critical ON model. I'm going to describe this model on the next page. But let me just write the value that we find. And it's this.
So
So why is the critical element not important? Well, this is where the thermal free energy failed. So I have to admit I was quite nervous when doing this calculation because it had a real chance to fail here. So this is the action that we're writing down. Phi here is some n-component vector of real scalar fields. So the UV fixed point is just when all of these things are zero. And the UV F value, by the way, when I say F value, I just mean the value of the free energy at the fixed point. It's just n times that of a real scalar field. So the critical OM model fixed point, we tune m not equals zero along the RG flow, and then this puts us exactly in the configuration we were talking about on the previous few slides, and I can just use this minus zeta 3 over 8 pi squared result that I wrote on the last slide, and I see that there's some order 1 correction to the free energy. But there's also another phase of this theory. When I keep, sorry, this should be m naught squared, when I keep the mass squared negative, then I have spontaneous symmetry breaking, and I go to the Goldstone phase of n minus 1 free fields. And I can flow from the critical ON model fixed point to this Goldstone phase. So the critical ON model fixed point better have an F value that's bigger than this Goldstone phase. And I'm comparing two order 1 numbers, and so it doesn't have to work out. And if you actually do it, you have to compare these two numbers. And it's pretty amazing that it actually ends up being negative when you just look at it. You're comparing 2 log 2 with 5 zeta 3 over pi squared. And when I was pressing enter in Mathematica, I was kind of closing my eyes. But it it works. It's pretty amazing. So this is a good sign that we're on the right track. So does everyone understand this example?
So when you are talking about large n and double traces, so in this example, this is the vector large n model. So does it apply to matrix large n theories or
it does.
Counting is different?
It does. Well, what I've just been talking about doesn't. Well, this slide doesn't apply, but I'll return to some of these matrix large n models in a few slides. There, it turns out that we can actually do a lot more in some cases, because there we often have these M-theory duals and such things. Okay, so this is my final example without supersymmetry. And I'm including this example because it's going to lead naturally into talking about supersymmetry. But so here's my Lagrangian. Well, this is just the Lagrangian of Chern-Simons theory with a Yang-Mills term. And in three dimensions, E squared has dimensions of mass, flows to infinity in the infrared. And so the Maxwell term just doesn't becomes unimportant in the infrared. So when the gauge group is U1, this is a famous result by Widen. The F value is simply 1/2 log K, where K is the Chern-Simons level. So I'm not going to derive this. I'm just going to assume that people know this result. So what happens when we add in some flavors? So in particular, what happens when we add in a large number of flavors? So we want to add in a large number of Dirac fermions and complex scalars, which are charged under this gauge group. So at leading order, we just have free Dirac fermions and free scalars. And then we have some contribution from the gauge field. And this kind of looks like 1/2 log k, but we also have the number of flavors adding in quadrature with the Chern-Simons level. And so this is an interesting result, and it takes a bit of computation to get it. I'll kind of sketch how you do it. So let's just consider Dirac fermions for simplicity. It works the same for the scalars. So here's the partition function we need to evaluate. I'm just going to get rid of the gauge transformation part and talk about what I've defined here as B. So F naught here, this is the free energy of just ng Dirac fermions. And then what's left is some induced action. This is after I've done the integral over psi, is some induced action for the B field. And this is what it turns out to be. So the first term is just the Chern-Simons part. But then we also have some contribution from the flavors. And if you actually compute what this thing is, you're computing this thing just in the unperturbed fixed point of nd Dirac fermions, then you can see it goes like, it scales like nd. This two-point function of the current scales like nd. And it's quadratic in b. So you can see that that k and nd are kind of on the same footing. They're both multiplying quadratic functionals of b. So it's not too surprising that when we actually compute this one-loop determinant that we get a result which adds k and nd up in quadrature inside of this log. So that's kind of a heuristic argument. Obviously, you can make this more precise. But does everyone understand the motivation here? So it's actually a pretty complicated calculation to get that result. But it turns out when we have supersymmetry, we can actually do this much more easily. It goes from being a from being a 5-page calculation to a 3-line calculation. So let me tell you a bit about what's involved. But before doing that, since you might not all be familiar with supersymmetry in 3 dimensions, here's a 1-page introduction to supersymmetry in 3 dimensions. So we can get n=2 supersymmetric multiplets in 3 dimensions by dimensionally reducing n=1 supersymmetric multiplets in 4 dimensions. So let's look at the vector multiplet first. So in an n=2 vector multiplet, I have a gauge field, I have a scalar, and I have a complex spinner, and they're all in the adjoint representation. This real scalar came from the fourth component of the gauge field in four dimensions. An n=2 chiral multiplet has a complex scalar and a complex spinner, the same as in 4 dimensions, as an n=1 multiplet in 4 dimensions. I can construct n=4 multiplets. The n=4 vector multiplet just has an n=2 vector multiplet and an n=2 chiral multiplet. And an n=4 hypermultiplet has 2 n=2 chiral multiplets, and they're in conjugate representations of the gauge group. So the amazing thing that we can do with supersymmetry is that we can localize the partition function, and we can turn a path integral into just an integral. So let me sketch how you do this. The basic idea is that we want to deform the action. So let me define some deform action ST here. Q is a supercharge, and calligraphic V is just some functional of my fields. And I want to choose this so that this combination QV is positive definite. You'll see why that's important. Now, if V is some gauge invariant and Poincaré invariant functional, then QV is Q exact. Sorry. Is Q exact. And this is because Q squares to some bosonic transformation. So, namely, to gauge transformations and Lorentz transformations. So, if I take the derivative of the partition function, now evaluated with this action ST, then it's a short calculation to see that actually the partition function doesn't depend on T at all. So why is this useful? I can take T to be large. And since QV is positive definite, then the partition function localizes configurations where QV equals 0. So does this idea make sense to people? So we're taking a partition function, and we're reducing it to something simpler. So this is what we have to do. we have to find the configurations of this modified action, which obey this requirement Q of equals zero. And then we have to consider some fluctuations around this. So in practice, it's sensible to do something like this. This is the v you want to take for the vector multiplet, and that's the v you want to take for the chiral multiplet, roughly speaking. And if you do that, you see that you localize the Coulomb branch. So you just end up with a normal integral over the Cartan subalgebra of the gauge group. So let me give you an example so you can see actually how simple this ends up being. So the simplest theory that we can do is just an n equals 4 U1 theory with no Chern-Simons level and n pairs of oppositely charged chiral multiplets. So now we just have to do one integral. This cosh pi lambda to the end, this is what you get from doing this one loop determinant. I'm not going to derive that, just take my word for it, but you can go through and that's what you'll find. So here we can just exactly evaluate the partition function. And we can expand this at large n, and this is what we find. And this n log 2, we can understand this using our non-supersymmetric result. Remember, n is the number of flavors. And we have 2n chiral multiplets. So each chiral multiplet contributed log 2 over 2. So we just get n log 2. And then the second term here, this is exactly what we had inside of that log. We have no Chern-Simons level, so that's not there. But this is the same result, and here you just have to do one integral. And it's a pretty amazing and powerful result. So we can repeat this at increasing levels of complexity. We can add in a Chern-Simons level and consider n equals 3 supersymmetry. And again, it agrees exactly. Now, there's one complication in going to n equals 2 supersymmetry. And that's what I want to mention. So in n equals 2 theories, the R symmetry is abelian. What this means is the R symmetry of the IR fixed point is not necessarily the same as the R symmetry in the UV. It can mix with other global abelian symmetries. So in general, the R symmetry in the UV is going to be some combination of our R symmetry. Our R symmetry in the IR is going to be some combination of our R symmetry in the UV plus some other global symmetries. And so how do we determine the correct R symmetry? This is a result thanks to Jaffris. What we want to do is called Z-extremization. So what I've written here, R of Xi, this is the R symmetry, the R charge of this chiral field Xi in the IR. Little r is the R charge in the UV. And then these TAs indicate how the R symmetry mixes with the other global abelian symmetries. And if I take the derivative of the partition function with respect to T, this is proportional to a one-point function. And it's a one-point function of a local scalar operator, and this has to vanish at conformal fixed points. So this tells us that if we calculate the partition function as a function of the chiral R charges, then the partition function is extremized at the correct IR CFT. And moreover, if you take two derivatives, you actually see that you find something negative definite, and this tells us that F is maximized. So this is what I mean when I say F maximization. I went kind of quickly, but does the general idea make sense? So let me give you an example of this. So let me consider an n equals 2 theory with some Chern-Simons level and n pairs of oppositely charged chiral multiplets. When k equals 0, the difference between this theory and the n equals 4 theory is just that I don't have a superpotential. So what abelian symmetries can the R symmetry mix with? Well, there are two that it potentially could. One rotates Q and Q tilde by the same phase, and the other rotates Q and Q tilde by opposite phases. But the one which rotates Q and Q tilde by opposite phases this is just part of the gauge group. This is just the U1 gauge group. So we don't consider that. We just consider the RM symmetry mixing with the U1, which rotates Q and Q tilde by the same phase. And so this is the integral you have to do. K here is the Chern-Simons level. This L is some complicated function of special functions. It's not too important what it is. And delta here is the trial R charge. So I need to calculate this partition function as a function of delta, and then find the delta which maximizes it. And so I can do this in perturbation theory in 1 over n. I can't evaluate this integral exactly. And that's what these solid lines are. The points come from actually doing this numerically. And so I'm drawing this with Chern-Simons level and without Chern-Simons level. The darker curves correspond to higher Chern-Simons levels. And this is actually, it's quite simple to get this. And I want to emphasize how hard it is to do this without supersymmetry. Because, so delta at a conformal fixed point, the R charge is equivalent to the scaling dimension. So this is telling us the scaling dimension. And if you want to calculate the scaling dimension, say just the first correction, just the one loop correction in 1 over n without supersymmetry, it's a very long calculation using Feynman diagrams. And you can check that it actually the first correction is the same as you get using this localization result. So this is powerful because it allows us to compute these scaling dimensions easily, and often the scaling dimensions resemble the non-supersymmetric cousins of these theories. So you should really think of this as a tool for computing scaling dimensions. So it's pretty remarkable that we can do it so easily. How much time do I have? I'm pretty much out of time.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just mention one more slide. I'm not going to be able to talk about a renormalized entanglement entropy, but that's okay. And this gets back to the question you were asking earlier. So another thing that you can do here is that you can consider large NC field theories with M-theory duals. So for example, if you take some Calabi-Yau cone over some compact 7-manifold Y, and you stick NC M2 brains at the tip, then you zoom in close to the M2 brains, and your supergravity solution is this ADS4 times Y. And this is dual to some large NC field theory. And it's a result that was first noticed by Klebanov and Seidlin, that the number of degrees of freedom scales as nc to the 3/2. So this F here, you can compute it in a number of ways. And they all agree. So the first way that you were to try to do this is by just computing the on-shell supergravity action. And this will give you this F equals nc to the 3/2. Another way is you can compute the entanglement entropy holographically. We know by the work of Myers and Castine Huerta that the entanglement entropy is equivalent, the entanglement entropy across the circle is equivalent to the 3-sphere free energy. And this also agrees. But finally, we can use localization. In cases where we know where the dual field theory is, we can write down these matrix models, these integrals, we can evaluate them at large NC, and we exactly reproduce this result, which is pretty amazing. That all of these ways actually work, and not only do they work, but we can actually calculate this every way essentially that you can think of calculating it. So I just want to stress that these are quantities which we can actually calculate, and we can calculate in non-trivial cases. For example, you could imagine trying to test 1 over NC corrections by looking at F. This would be one way in which you could test 1 over NC corrections to the ADS-C of T correspondence. So I was going to tell you more about renormalized entanglement entropy, but that's okay. I'll save that for another day. So I guess let me skip ahead. Question?
So the part you didn't show us, did you do some calculations of the entanglement entropy?
Yeah,
maybe
so...
Maybe you could just summarize.
Yeah, I can summarize it real quick. So this here, these are numerical calculations that I'm showing you. We had the plot on the left is if we normalize entanglement entropy for a free massive scalar. I showed this plot earlier. The one on the right is for a free massive fermion. And to actually compute this renormalized entanglement entropy, you have to stick these theories on the lattice and actually construct the reduced density matrix, trace over it. But the amazing thing is that it actually works and it gives you the right value at the fixed points. And we can do this. And then...
Which theories were these? Free mass?
This is a free massive scalar on the left.
Yeah.
And a free massive fermion on the right. This is 2 plus 1 dimensions. This is the entanglement entropy across the circle, or the renormalized entanglement entropy. And...
Did you get the non-universal part of it, the cutoff dependent part?
Well, here I'm just plotting the renormalized entanglement entropy, which gets rid of that.
I know, but I...
Yeah, we also have the other terms. But right here I'm just plotting the universal part. And then this dotted orange line on both of these plots, this is some analytic approximation at large mass. So it actually turns out that you can relate these corrections. So at large mass, you see that the free energy, this is the last equation we're looking at. It goes like 1 over m, and then it has a 1 over m cubed term, and so on. And it turns out that the coefficient of the 1 over m term is related to the anomaly coefficient and four dimensions for the free massless scalar. And the coefficient of the 1 over mr cubed term is related to the anomaly coefficient in six dimensions. So this is Huerta first noticed this and checked this for the 1 over mr term. And I thought this was really cool, so I wanted to do the 1 over mr cubed term. And to do that, you actually need to know what is the form of entanglement entropy for a general entangling surface in six dimensions? And this isn't something that anyone knew, so I just tried calculating it. And then while going through this machinery, you end up with a specific coefficient in front of the 1 over mr cubed term, and it actually matches the numerics. It's pretty amazing that all these things agree. And so I think it would be cool to try to, maybe you can actually sum this series. Maybe we can learn something this way. And then the other examples where we can compute renormalized entanglement entropy are when we have holographic RG flows. And so this is some plot on the left from a holographic RG flow. This is a dual to some combining gauge theory. So again, it falls off like 1 over R in the infrared. It looks quite similar to the scalar case. Any other questions?
Do you have some further interpretation of what this F means or this C or so? Because, I mean, it's very interesting that there is something like this, but when you can relate it to an anomaly or something, you
yeah.
know that it has, you understand in some way its place in the theory.
So
here you've just defined some, you might think it's just ad hoc, right? I mean, it's
right.
It has a feeling that it's more fundamental, but can you say what it might mean?
So right now, all we have is an observation. We have an observation that this quantity, which seems completely random, satisfies this amazing property. And it's an unknown question what it really means. And I think it's maybe the most interesting question here, is really understanding what this F is. And I think one way which you could try to go about this is by trying to find a better C function, a better function along the RG flow. For example, in four dimensions, this proof by Komogorsky and Schwimmer, they actually gave us a bit of insight into what's going on. And same with Zamolodnikov's proof in two dimensions. It gives us some insight in some structure. But with this entanglement entropy, we use things like strong subadditivity. These aren't things which we have, or at least I have, much intuition for, which would really tell us things in words which we know and which we understand, which we like to hear things said in. So I think it would be really interesting to try to really understand what this F is and what's going on here.
The way you presented it was in terms of spheres. Mm-hmm. Is there some general, but at the end you sort of indicated something more general. Can that version of it be
generalized that,
to?
Do you mean this formula here or?
Your definition of the normalized.
Yeah, so at the fixed points, the entanglement entropy across the circle is equivalent to the partition function on the three sphere. But in between, that's not true. And so in between, this is where the renormalized entanglement entropy comes in. When I want to plot something along the RG flow, I have to calculate the entanglement entropy. I can't look at the sphere anymore. So all of these plots, like this plot.
Is the entanglement entropy of the sphere, or is it more general?
It's across the circle.
So that's what I mean, but can it be a lower dimensional sphere? But can you use any shape region? It has to be a sphere.
It seems like it has to be a circle. So one way of seeing this is you could ask the same thing in four dimensions. And in four dimensions, as soon as your entangling region isn't a sphere, you get contributions from the C anomaly coefficient.
So that's also a bit mysterious.
That's also a bit mysterious why the sphere is special.
Why is it special about it?
Yeah. I agree. It's something we should understand better. Any other questions?
No more questions. Let's thank Ben again.